Hi and welcome. This is Dave. I appreciate the emails that you've sent with responses to the question and feedback about the seminar. I hope I've begun to address some of the questions that you've asked, especially Brenda's initial question about explaining quantum physics, but really I want to explain it more in the sense of how our minds and brains work and what we can use from that science, basically, to help us understand more about it. We're going to be talking today about what I believe is the most important variable to determine success for us as coaches and for our clients, and that's the mastery of regulating states of mind. And I want to show you how important it is in coaching and how important it is for your clients to be able to understand and master that through your help. And the distinctions that it can make for you in knowing how to do this and how and being able to guide your clients to have mindfulness and self-reflection in this way. But first, I want to see if there are any other comments or questions, anything that you'd like us to talk about before moving into the topic for today. Anyone? One of the questions that Lucy asked was, as coaches, how do we get our clients to believe and trust that we're sharing, that what we're sharing about the possibility of change through the focus on our inner thoughts and dyed-in-the-wool programming, how do we do that? I think it's not a matter of convincing someone intellectually or trying to sell it. It's simply a matter of engaging a client to look at what their story is and to listen to how they construct that story and to look at ways they may be limiting themselves. We're going to be looking at that in more detail in seminars 3 and 4, and specifically to look at a system that I want to share with you to deconstruct a story and to reconstruct a new one using some of the basic principles that we're going to talk about today and along with that discussion. So it's really a way that we don't have to convince someone to change, but the primary variable that we have in engaging with someone is the degree of confidence that we have in ourselves. I want to give you a quiz, each of you. And this is from the Wharton School, and a couple of you may have heard this before. And I'm interested in your response to this. The Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to look at what was the primary variable that determined whether someone signed on for professional services or declined. And it was the same variable in both instances, to decline or to sign on. So what do you think it was? The reputation of the professional, the degree of experience, the credentials and certifications the professional had, the amount of the fee, or the state of the economy? What's your guess? Anyone? Take a chance. Anybody want to guess? It's none of the above. It was the degree of clarity and confidence that the professional had in making the recommendation for the professional service and stating the fee. And that is something that we communicate midbrain to midbrain, because someone has, and state of confidence, the amount of confidence is a state of mind. And that's, I kind of want to set up our discussion in that way, and I'd like you, if you would like to look at this a little bit more, the first blog that I have under my archives of blogs at mentorpath.com is Confident is a State of Mind. And to look at that, when you have a chance, you can sign up for the blog and get future blogs if you're interested, but to look at that and to look at an application of what we're going to talk about tonight, about an application of confidence and specifically it being a state of mind. So I want to introduce the idea of states of mind, of looking at how practical it is, because it has to do with not only how effectively we can work with someone, but whether we're going to work with someone or not, whether we get a client to work with, and having the confidence to do that. And I'm going to talk about us regulating our states of mind and creating a real mastery of that, as well as helping our clients do that. Now, I sent around a worksheet called the Neuroconditioning Work Page, and I want to make a reference to that. So if you have it printed out in front of you, that's great. It's a neuroconditioning to make changes that last. And I want to give you a couple of examples of how to apply this, because this chart, I think, can be of particular use to you, and I want to show you more of how to use it. But let me pause again. Any questions or comments, thoughts about what you'd like to talk about or discuss, or questions that come to you about this whole area? All right, I'm feeling a little lonely here. Nobody going to talk to me? Anything you'd like to be sure that we talk about or discuss in this particular topic tonight? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on mute, on lecture mode, so you don't have to worry about being on mute. But I want to save some time for us to discuss in the end. So jot down any questions you have about this, and we'll definitely have a bit of time in the end to discuss. Okay, first to discuss states of mind. I want to look at just an understanding of what we're talking about with states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and how we process information, and then, of course, how we respond. Now, a state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavior patterns. A key element of mentor coaching someone is to help a client become aware of various states of mind with particular focus of what state works best for what purpose. In other words, if somebody is in a creative state for writing, for example, then that's a particular state of mind, and to sustain that state can be very productive, to not have interruptions and that sort of thing. Editing that same work is a different state of mind. It involves a different part of the brain. So it's useful to look at what state works best for what. Now, I want to give you an illustration, just a very simple concept of what states of mind are, because we all have different states of mind, from being 10-point alert when we're about to do a presentation to, you know, having a very grounded and centered experience and a creative reverie of looking at different thoughts in a free flow of consciousness, all the way to being very somnolent, very sleepy and relaxed when we go to sleep, a whole number of different states of mind. So here's an illustration of how specific a state of mind can be, because a state of mind can contain a lot of information, like a software program. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you can teach the rat to get to the cheese, and then it can go again and again. Now, if you take another rat, and before you teach it to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, creating just a little bit of an altered state, kind of simulating a stress state. You teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It has in a part of its brain the knowledge of how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it. And it can literally die in that maze of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain how to get there. Now, you re-inject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning and state-dependent memory. So this is an example of two distinct states of mind without any overlap. It's really more of something like extreme stress, like post-traumatic stress disorder, where an entire event may not be remembered in the usual way. But a more common example is when you try to think of somebody's name, and you know it, you just can't quite think of it, it's on the tip of your tongue, but you just can't recall it. Then, in a later, more relaxed state, the name immediately comes to you. And another example, where you predictably get annoyed or irritated, that you respond out of character or say something that you may later think, no, this isn't the real me. It's a different state of mind. Now, a state of mind is a mind-body state, like, as I mentioned, a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So each of us has a range of states, and it's important to become aware of what state to enter for what purpose. I want to give you a couple of examples using this chart in just a moment, but I want to do a little bit more of the groundwork for appreciating this and appreciating what the importance is. I want to talk a little bit about how to access different mind states. The regulation of feelings and states of mind involve the understanding and mastery of access to a particular state of mind without altering consciousness to do so. In other words, while staying present. And I want to give you some examples of this. Probably nowhere is this more poignant than with artists and writers who want to enter a creative state. So they're very mindful of this. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to entering the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin, and one of my favorite nonfiction writers, Diane Ackerman, wrote on a pine plank while soaking in a bathtub to free their thought processes. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship taken for sail during an incredible storm so he would come back in and recreate this experience on canvas. And some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. Now, this corresponding state of mind of the reader often matches with that of the author, in which the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. The most natural way of regulating state change is distraction, like jangling car keys to shift a crying infant to suddenly focus on that and get in a calmer state. And we each have various ways to reconnect the mind and body, like getting grounded in physical activity, walking outdoors, a warm shower, or breathing exercises. We're going to discuss how to do this with clients in just a few moments. Now, a mentor coaching application here. It's important for us as mentor coaches to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand their subjective experience, as well as the story that they communicate. Now, developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally way before the verbal linguistic abilities of the left brain mature. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right brain to right brain communication of emotional states of coaching clients. And that's where our intuition comes in. And this intuition means that we need to remain open to receiving communication from the client's right brain to become attuned to the state of mind of the client. This precedes synthesizing and strategy and understanding their story. So what this means practically is the most important thing that you can do to prepare for working with a client is to take just a moment before you receive, I'll put it in my terms because I do all my work by telephone, to take a moment before you receive the call, the top of the hour, for example, and spend a moment just to get really centered and grounded so that you are totally present, so that you have access to all of your states of mind. Because in any altered state, you're in one of those software programs, and that fixes the focal length, and you don't have access often to all of the information and experience of other states of mind. Not as extreme as the rat, but you have the full scope and range of possibility when you're very centered and grounded. So doing that can be helpful. And for example, once a client begins with you, if they're not really centered and grounded, if they're in an upset frame of mind, for example, one of the most important things I think you can do is to help them get centered and grounded so that they can really participate fully. Just as an example, a couple of times a client will call, has called and said, I just had something really upsetting happen, and they described it for me and said, I don't think I could really make use of this time today, so maybe we could reschedule. And in both instances, I ask, I've been mentor coaching for over a decade, and it only happened a couple of times, so I'm going to give you an example of it because it's poignant and maybe helpful. I said, I would suggest that we take just a moment for you to do a relaxation exercise with me to get really centered and grounded and then decide. Now, first, I think it's most useful, which I didn't say, is to resonate with the client and empathically resonate to say, I know I hear how upsetting that was for you. I would suggest that we take just a moment to do a grounding and centering exercise and then to decide. And inevitably, so I would do a progressive relaxation with someone and just spend a minute or minute and a half doing a relaxation exercise. And each time, they were totally ready to do the work and did the work in a much more meaningful way, because it's not something just to get beyond and get back to the work. That becomes the work, because the learning how to self-reflect and ultimately to self-regulate is one of the most important things that we can do with a client. Now, here's an application, and then I want to talk a little bit about how to, kind of in reverse order. And it's important, I think, to recognize and understand emotional couplings. And I want to look at it in broader view and then sort of deconstruct it. Regardless of how logical you think you are, your first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any new input, any stimulus, goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain, then to the hippocampus, also in the midbrain, to attach meaning. So this is the, as we talked a little bit last time, the side of the unconscious where meaning's attached. Then it goes up to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually to make logical sense. So notice how the emotional activation registers before the cognitive conscious areas of the brain ever come into play to assess options. Neuroscientists have demonstrated that we make decisions, for example, a buy or purchase decision, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of it. I do some research with a neuroscientist at Loyola Marymount, the executive MBA program, and one of the things we've looked at is this very process that's come out of another lab, a neurofocus lab, about how we make emotional decisions first, then process it to become consciously aware of it. So what that means is once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a no or a yes, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision. And this is confirmation bias. And some neuroscientists say even that the primary purpose of the forebrain is to make decisions that are made at the midbrain unconsciously to make those conscious and logical and reasonable. So this is why it's so helpful to be aware, because, you know, we buy emotionally and justify logically. Now, the reason that's so important is our state of mind determines the meaning we attach to something, and the meaning we attach determines the behavior. So when we make a choice, we couple memory and wisdom from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. And the part of the brain that anticipates a pleasant outcome, the pleasure center, the nucleus accumbens, releases a substance of dopamine, very much like a hit of coke, that activates a buy decision. Anytime we anticipate buying something or anticipate pleasure, we get a hit of dopamine. We get a pleasure response. The don't buy decision, the pain response, originates in the insula. It's an area that's involved in anticipating pain. So look at a practical application here. Credit cards decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, with paying, the activation of the pain center, having to give up something that's yours, your money. The pleasure of purchase is then segmented from the pain of future payment. This segmentation simply renders repayment a future abstraction. And even an optimism bias can come into play and say, well, I'll have more money later on or next month. So this is one of the reasons that people spend on average 23% more with a credit card than they do cash or check. It's also hard to save because the way our minds work and our brains are wired. The immediate pleasure of buying has the very real response of the pleasure hormone, dopamine. Making and spending money both activate the pleasure center. To save for the future, a future need, long-term saving, retirement, you have to substitute a theory, an abstract idea about a future reward. So that's why some people really have difficulty in doing that. So let's look at how do you regulate states of mind? How do you regulate yours? How do you help your clients do that? The most important thing that we can do to achieve success, in my view, is to manage our emotions and regulate our states of mind. I also work with performance professionals, actors, and pro athletes, and nowhere is this more poignant than in those arenas about how vital it is to regulate states of mind. It's more immediate because you get immediate feedback. For CEOs, it's just as important, but the feedback isn't as immediate because it's not as vivid, as distinct. Now, let me ask you what you think about this. What do you think these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain, Philip Seymour Hoffman. They never learned the crucial success strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or other addictive substances or processes to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. That's why state of mind is so important and why state of mind in coaching should always come first before story and strategy. I'm going to return to that in a minute. Now, there are two primary ways to regulate a state of mind, physiology and focus. Physiology is how we use our bodies, our biochemistry to change our state of mind. For example, relaxation, deep breathing, meditation. Focus. What and how you focus on. Remember, we talked about last time the from quantum physics, the principles of the quantum Zeno effect. What you focus on determines how your energy field is aligned. What you focus on is what you get. You don't get what you want. You get what you focus on. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. Remember, the paying attention, focusing on the jangling keys for the infant, instantly changes the state of mind. And your state of mind then determines the meaning you attach to something. And the meaning you attach will determine your behavior. That's why it's such an important aspect to regulate a state of mind. Your power is in what you focus on. Now, the questions we ask determine what we focus on. There are a couple of questions we're always asking ourselves. What does this mean? And what should I do? If you have an habitual feeling you don't like, it can come from a repeated focus and a question. Why does this always happen to me? The presupposition is that you're in a passive position and you're ineffective and you have an activity as if something bad should happen. Why am I overweight? The focus is on overweight, not on something positive. Remember, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Diet focuses on the negative. So you're creating a focus that's not going to work. The quality of your life comes down to the quality of the questions you ask daily. Change the questions. Ask a better question. Now, from the minute we're waking up, we're asking ourselves questions, even though we may not consciously be aware of them. As soon as you wake up, before your feet ever hit the carpet, you're immediately asking questions. It may be, what can go wrong today? Or can I really do this? Or, man, this is going to be a terrific day. I'm going to seize this day and look at the things that I can create today. So, and I've done this with a couple of people who have been preoccupied at their companies and their people. These were both owners or CEOs of companies who each of them had had a particularly disastrous set of things that had happened, one an event, another series of events at their companies. And they were going through several months of just a real funk and preoccupied and anxious, worried about getting sued. And what I suggested to each of them in totally different times, what I suggested is when you first get up, what's your first thought? And you know, both of them said some variation of, you know, what can go wrong today? You know, what's going to happen today? Or the attorney's going to... And I said, as soon as you wake up, that question determines your focus, and you're in a negative mindset, just as certainly as if you would get up and stub your toe in the next several hours, you're in a bad mindset. Your state of mind determines what happens. Your focus determines your state of mind. So what I suggested to each of these people was to write down three questions before they go to bed, three questions that put them in a peak state of mind, peak performance, that really empowered them. And, you know, an example, but I didn't tell them what to write, but I said, yeah, you know, what can I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of and have fun doing it? But to write three questions that put them in a peak state and were empowering, that as soon as they turned on their bedside lamp, they would answer these, they would pick this up and answer these three questions. And each of them talked about this being a total turnaround for them and how they were then able to direct their companies in a much better way. Now, this is simply saying your brain follows your focus, whether it's positive or negative. Ask questions that habitually empower you. Instead of, why am I overweight? What can I do today for better nutrition and physical shape? Asking effective questions determines your state of mind. This is your power of focus. So ask habitual questions that empower you, because you're already doing it anyhow. Just make it conscious and make it ones that enhance you. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions and get us to use our own resources. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David simply asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but he asked, do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? And listen to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO at Apple in the mid-90s. When they were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, Jobs simply asked Sculley, do you want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world? So I would suggest that you try this. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state. And each morning, answer these three empowering questions and feel the answer. Remember, you're already asking questions anyhow. This just changes the focus to occasionally engineer those questions that can empower you. So I want to talk about an application here about self-regulation, and we're moving toward this chart that you have, the neuroconditioning chart. But I want to talk about mantras and self-regulation. And here's a story of the application, then we're going to talk about the principles. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage out of 217 teams in their division nationwide. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. It was a cue and a focus and a physiology. The cue, he suggested, and he suggested each of these. He didn't tell them what to do, so they would make it their own story. He suggested the cue would be to dribble the basketball twice, And while they were doing that, the cue was for the purpose of a focus, which he suggested be a phrase, such as relaxed and smooth, and that it be coupled with the physiology, with a deep breath in of relaxation and a deep breath out to breathe out any tension. So in 4 or 5 seconds, they were doing this. Dribble twice, the focus of the phrase and the deep breathing. Then in addition, he simulated game conditions by abruptly stopping a player in practice and asking them to shoot 2 free throws, which is a game condition, because in a real game, you don't get to line up and shoot 30 and count the best. He simulated the mindset of pressure in a game by suddenly stopping to shoot, and if the player made the shot, he got to take a breather. If he missed, he had to sprint around the court. In 2 years, the team was ranked number 1 in their division nationwide. So there are 3 parts to a mantra, a cue, like 2 dribbles or some personal gesture, and a phrase and a deep breath. What my mantra, before I do say a keynote, since I don't use to carry a basketball with me, and I want to do something not so obvious, is I put my index finger and my thumb together on both hands to form 2 little circles, and then touch those at the center so I have an infinity sign. At the same time, I'm saying the phrase relaxed and powerful, and taking a deep breath in and breathing out any tension. I do 2 deep breaths in and out. So in 3 or 4 seconds, I'm ready to go and primed with a state of mind that is absolutely ready to do the keynote. So now mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. So mantras can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. So, now, let's talk about neural conditioning. What we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. So, to change our behavior, change your neural association. In other words, thinking positively is not enough. You can think positively for a moment, but then you go back to what's already been established in your brain and those neuronal networks and connections in your brain. It would be the same as trying to change a software program by booting it up and talking positively to your computer. The stimulus response is already there in your brain, even if you don't believe it or know it's there. It's linked. Winston tastes good. Now, what's your association? For 80% of adults, it's like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you have a strong belief linking smoking and cancer, even if you happen to have heard it, it's been 30 years since you last heard it. So what you link inside your head, the meaning that you give, determines your behavior. And this is how neuromarketing works to resonate with their identity. Our choices come from the deepest sense of who we are. But you can change your behavior when you change the meaning. And I want to show you how to do that in a moment. And grab your chart, your neurocondition chart. You can reprogram your associations and rewire your brain. Reprogramming, neuroconditioning, is a process. It's not an event. You can't work out one time and be healthy for life. A neural association gets linked or anchored by the coupling of strong emotion to whatever's happening around you at the time. This creates a link. And anchors happen when you're in a highly emotional state. Now, this can happen in one of a couple of broad ways. One is in a traumatic way. You're in the bunker shell in Vietnam and come back and a car backfires and you automatically jump. Or it can be downloaded and ingrained so much in childhood that it becomes part of the neural wiring that you have. Remember, we talked about 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. Look at the neuroconditioning chart and the 4 columns. The emotional trigger is whatever the cue is emotionally that triggers someone. And that's what creates the instantaneous state change. Let me give you a couple of examples. When I first originated this chart, I was working with an executive woman who very high functioning, very successful, very happy in her life, except on major holidays like Thanksgiving or Christmas, usually twice a year, she would go home and she could maintain her composure for about a day, but then she would kind of, it would wear thin and she would inevitably get into a real difficult time with her parents. And as we began to talk about this, she talked about the different emotional triggers. What I suggested to her was that she set aside a brainstorming time for herself with no interruption to really get in a state of mind that she would stay very grounded and reflect, not to go back into these states, but reflect on them and think about every one of the triggers that would be state-changing for her when she was with her family. And I knew some examples to give her a couple. The way her dad would roll his eyes around something that she did, the couple of phrases that her mother would repeat, but to write down every one of the triggers that she instantly responded to with anger or irritation. And then, for each trigger, what was the usual response or behavior that she would have? Because in that nanosecond of being triggered would be a state change. So it's not the content of that material. And this is why with therapy, people often get stuck, because going back into the old story to create a new story etches the old story further. And understanding the content of the story doesn't make a difference. Looking at the content of the software doesn't help to be effective to shift the software program back to one that's current and grounded. So to get these first two columns down is to have an awareness of all the things that are triggering and an awareness of how these are state changing, so that you can cue your radar to be aware of each of these as soon as possible, rather than several hours into it and in a depleted state, depleted energy later. Now, and to have a way of creating a regulation, that third column, to have a mantra, a cue, a focus, and a physiology that as soon as there's an awareness of this trigger, that instead of cueing that old behavior, that old state of mind, and getting lost in that and continuing that, to instead use that to cue a grounding and a centering, and then to have pre-planned for each of the cues the ideal response or behavior, so that someone is aware immediately and then they can cue a grounding and a movement toward an ideal behavior. Now, this has to be done a number of times, but when it's done repeatedly, the trigger is defused, because the trigger is used to move to an ideal response or behavior because the brain's rewired. The software program is revised and the brain is rewired. And this is how we create any change that lasts. I'll go into that a little bit more in a moment. But to create any change that will last, we have to reprogram our brain and revise our mind software. So the being aware of the emotional trigger and the usual response, we're creating an awareness of the software that's there in place to begin to rewire it with that mantra, the third column, and to create a new association to move immediately into. Now, this takes some work, and it takes several times of getting grounded and centered again in the beginning. So here are a couple of things that I think are really important. There are two forces behind all behavior. The desire to gain pleasure, in other words, to move toward, to gain, and the need to avoid pain, to move away, to prevent pain. To understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. That's how our brains work. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis because it's painful to change. So our brain has that error detection mechanism, and it naturally, instinctively wants to avoid change because that's the way we're wired, to avoid pain to survive. And change registers the same as any other kind of pain. Trying to create success by creating more pain unless achieving that success usually doesn't work. So to gain or prevent pain moves us in every personal and business decision. An example of a gain, promotion, making more money, improving our lives, get what you desire. Examples of preventing pain, to avoid change, to buy insurance, to save money, to stay away from something we're afraid of. So, as a specific example, in any moment, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight. The pleasure of the cheesecake is more enjoyable right now than the future idea of being out of shape, especially if it has strawberry topping. Overweight is an abstract idea, not at the same level of sensory reality as an immediate pleasure. Spending money in this moment is a greater pleasure than the idea of a later gain of money by saving, or even the later pain of avoiding debt financially and emotionally. So, to change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. The need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure. And this drives much of human behavior. So to influence someone, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and what they link pleasure to. Now, here's a really practical application, because you're going to hear it with some variation of it in every client. They have established a goal, they know they want to do it, they're consciously motivated, but yet they avoid it. They don't do it. Now, if you're not doing something you want or need to do and have a good plan for, and that's the key too, there's some pain linked with doing it, and a greater pain linked with doing it than not doing it. Let's say, consciously and logically, you have a surface story of, you know, I want to generate more income and create wealth. You have a good plan, but yet you don't do it, as we talked in the first seminar. You don't have enough money or money that you want. Somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain to having it or to making the change to doing the things you need to do to get it, to enacting the plan and the strategy you have. So, unconsciously, you may think that money equals pain. For example, all this effort and I think I'm just as comfortable where I am. So the status quo is justified here. Well, I have to take advantage of people. Or people will judge me and I'll be ostracized. Or I'll be lonely at the top. Or I don't really think I know how to handle it. Listen to how all of those are justification for stopping. The real motivation is to avoid pain by stopping. And then the justification comes in. The action is at the midbrain, where the neural association is. And the reason that's attached seems like it makes sense, and that's the forebrain. And that's why thinking it through is not going to be the best plan when there's a neural association that goes the other direction. So if you're sabotaging any success in any area of your life, look at the approach of wanting pleasure and the avoidance of having fear. The usual focus is, what will be the pain if I do this? The need for focus, though, is what will be the pain if you don't follow through? What will be the cost and the pain if you don't do it? Now, we're defined by the stories we tell ourselves. So is your story empowering you, or is it causing you to fall short? Is your story a limiting story in any area of your life? Which is true? The one you pick will be the one you believe and live. Now, most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago, or the one they want to believe. Your story contains the patterns that shape your behavior. Here's another question. What's the biggest addiction that we have as human beings? The biggest addiction, the thing almost impossible to give up or to abstain from. The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and actually allows us to escape some of our fear. Our biggest addiction is our problems. Think about how many people are addicted to problems, to the negative. Now, in any situation, and this is crucial, I think, in mentor coaching, in any situation, there are three components: state of mind, story, and strategy. State management is the most important aspect, to choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome. Story is the organizer of what you do, the theme and storylines of what you're pursuing. For Martin Luther King, it was, I have a dream. Strategy is to move beliefs to behavior for successful performance. Most coaches start with strategy, but strategy is an involved part of the process. Reevaluate your approach, your state of mind. That's the key initial element. State always comes first, because that determines how we're going to perceive something, and how we perceive something is the meaning we attach that then determines behavior. So getting into a state of mind that is the proper software for a particular situation is the very best that we can do for someone. Think about how important the mindset, the software is. If you're in downtown Dallas and you need a map to navigate the city, a map of Houston is not going to help you. Even if you do it faster and better, it's not going to be helpful. It's the wrong map. It's the wrong mindset, the wrong state of mind. So here's a basic way of bringing this together. How do you condition yourself to make changes that last? How can you help your client condition himself or herself? There are three key principles to neural conditioning to create change to make it last. And have your four-column chart alongside you. First, identify what to change. You have to get to a point where you feel that you must change something. You must change it now, and that you can change it. This is where the belief of the coach, the confidence of the coach, is going to come into play. Must, can, and will change it. And to feel that not changing will be ultimately more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. We have to resonate with our clients about the uncertainty, the trepidation, the discomfort of change, of not knowing the outcome. Whatever it is, we have to resonate with that, because that will be calming. That will mean that we create an empathic resonance and a partnership of understanding, a common ground that you can move ahead. Change can be linked with pleasure. So here are a couple of steps to ask for this first step. A couple of questions to ask. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequence? What is the pain associated to your current choice that's now adaptive? Usually it means, if you look at it a certain way, you get to stop and you get to take off and go to the mall or jump in the pool instead of doing the changes necessary. And third, what will be the pleasure ultimately with changing? To create a greater pleasure for changing than the immediate pain of doing it. Two, interrupt the existing pattern. Recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. And this is where the chart comes in, to recognize those cues. A pattern has to be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. One of the more common mistakes that people make here is trying to add a new pattern onto the ones that already exist and think that somehow this new pattern is going to overwrite the ones that are already there. That's not true. The most powerful force of the human psyche is that we always return to our identity. So how we see ourselves, both our surface and shadow stories, how we see our identity, we're going to return to. So if we make a change, and we don't incorporate that as part of who and how we are, or don't have a mentor coach who can help us do that, then we're going to revert back to where things were before, so a change won't last. So this is the importance of helping a client incorporate that transformation of how they see themselves along with the changes in behavior they're making. A couple of questions for step two. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic pattern? This is where the chart comes in. Think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it. In other words, the cue, the usual response, and then first, instead of going from column two to column four, you cannot make that a one-step process. You have to stop in the way station of getting centered and grounded. Because when you get centered and grounded, column three, with the mantra, that's when you have access to all of the states of mind, and you can choose the state that best works for that situation. And third, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain, the pleasure you'll have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, if you're phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves into the new story. So a couple of questions to ask for step three. What is the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? What specifically is the change you want to bring about? Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you will have with the change. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that about one out of every 25 of his fellow prisoners somehow managed to survive. He set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference to help them survive. 24 out of every 25 focused on the instant death that was inevitable for them. The people who survived developed a reason to survive, a why, to create a meaning for their suffering rather than accepting their fate, focusing on the negative, wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, the 1 in 25 constructed a reason for surviving so that, for example, they could tell their story to their children, so that they could make certain that this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering. It transformed it to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of the suffering. They were able to make it through and had a will to live that helped pull them through the very hardest of times. So, this being grounded and centered allows a state of mind for optimum synthesis of thinking with access to all existing knowledge. And any kind of stress, any state-changing experience interferes by moving somebody into a state. Any state will narrow concentration and limit the scope and range of thinking. So that's why it's so important. Now, I want to stop here and see if there are any questions, but let me give one more example here. This is an illustration of a writer's block, which is a state of mind change. I'll call him Nathan. He was a well-known nonfiction writer, just off a New York Times bestseller. But he was experiencing a writer's block. He had not produced anything for a month when he called. And I asked him to explain his writing process, to walk me through it step by step, in detail, to describe what he did, what he was experiencing, the conversation he was having with himself in his head. He described how, as he sat down to write, he said, well, I get kind of nervous, and I began doing a lot of different things other than writing. Then I start wondering if I can produce another bestseller, or if it was just a one-time happening. Now, so after exploring the details of this process and his distractions, I could observe, it sounds like when you sit down, you get really excited, maybe more so now than ever, about immersing yourself in the passion you've always wanted to experience. We said, you know, that's right. And I said, when you read this excitement as anxiety, like in an old story or an old model, it puts you in your old story where anxiety equals danger. In that story, distracting yourself was adaptive. It was a way of regulating the tension. Here it's not working. This perception and coupling of meaning and coping mechanism were part of his old story that were now juxtaposed with this newly evolving story. And the cue. And the cue, the trigger, in that first column, is almost always some feeling. And the cue, the feeling for him, was a signal of excitement that he read in an old model as if it were anxiety, and that cued up the old program of distracting himself and doing things to try to, you know, get a way to regulate his state of mind, but then he got lost in the content, and the content was thinking that he wasn't going to be able to write another bestseller, and he was going to get, you know, get exposed, and, you know, and the work he had done before with a therapist and with another coach was looking at the meaning of all the content, which is not going to be useful. The key here was staying looking at and regulating his state of mind. So he reframed his excitement as a validation of being in a new experience and a signpost of progress. Hear the reframing here. A signpost of progress to continue moving ahead in his writing. The result, he produced an even bigger bestseller. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested what sense this makes to you, if there are other aspects that would be helpful for us to discuss. Questions, thoughts? Anyone? Would you like to hear another example of the use of this chart, or would you like to ask questions and have a discussion? I'm needing to know where you guys are to know if this is making sense to you, if it's really addressing some things that you find useful, or if we need to look at it a different way. So I'm curious, and I want to do the very best for each of you possible, so I'd like to hear from you. Anyone? Let me discuss just briefly then another use of this chart. I worked with a COO of a company, a chief operating officer. We worked together for a while, and he was doing great, and he decided to toss his hat in the ring for a CEO position. He took on a CEO position, and immediately he began getting into it with the CEO of another company that they were already into negotiations by the time my guy, and I'm going to call my guy Jim, the other guy Tom, my guy Jim would get triggered by some things that Tom would do. And Jim would say things like, well, you know, I every time Tom gets on his soapbox, and he talks down to me, explains simple things to me like he would to a novice, I overreact. I just want to tell him off. It feels like a put down. I'm gonna put us back on lecture mode because of the background noise. Hold on just a minute. So Jim recognized I have to think and not react, but I get sucked in even when I know what not to do. He just sets me off the way he talks down to me like that, like he knows it all. I can't not respond. I need a strategy. So we looked at what he could do and still be himself and be effective in those instances. He said, I have to think and not react. I have to let him finish his points and get the emotion out of it. So what he was saying is he needed to regulate his state of mind and manage his emotions in order to be effective. So what we did then is I asked him, same thing I mentioned initially, I asked him to schedule a time when he could just kind of think about this, not recreate the state and get triggered again, but to think about all the particular things. He described a few already, but to think about the particular things that Tom did that triggered him to react and to get into a place that he kind of lost his good balance and judgment. He lost his acting presidentially as a CEO. So he wrote down all the cues and his response to it. And then we worked on a way that as soon as he recognized each of these, he could develop a mantra, that he could do this at the conference table, and nobody would know, where he could get centered and then choose his response and write out beforehand, ideally, what he would do. So what he decided to do, and part of this was a prompt, a suggestion for me, is that while Tom was talking, he began writing, as he was aware of where he would have gone, he began writing out his response so that he was doing something actively, as he was inclined to do, but it was something that was in his best interest and was planned. And the other guy, Tom, was thinking, well, he's writing down everything I'm saying. So he looked pleased, according to Jim. So Jim thought he was, you know. So he planned out exactly how he would respond. And then instead of getting triggered and being off and running in a different direction, responding emotionally, he would respond from his ideal behavior that he had already jotted down notes for. So for everything that he would have been triggered to do, he had a specific system of recognizing, getting grounded, and then responding. So again, think about how here it's state, and then strategy, and then story. And that's why I emphasize state always comes first, and then strategy and story. And that's a simple example of how that can work in another instance in an applied mentor coaching way. Well, if you have questions or thoughts, send them to me in an email. I'm really curious about how this is hitting you and if it's really addressing some of the things in a meaningful way. Let me know. Give me feedback. And if there's something that you have as a question, send it along. I'm really eager to hear, and I want this to be one of the most successful and useful seminar series that you have. So help me if there's a way that I can be of better help to you. So thank you all very much, and I look forward to picking up right here next time. Bye now.